Hello, and welcome to the Rooted in Reliability podcast, your plant performance podcast, where we dive deeper into asset management techniques and know-how. I'm your host, James Kovacevic, and I will be your guide to achieving industry best practice. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is here to provide you with the insights to improve plant performance and deliver bottom-line results to your organization. In case you missed the last episode, you can find the Rooted in Reliability podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and on the reliability.fm network. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now let's dive into today's topic.
It is my pleasure to welcome back Rob Kalivorski to the podcast. Welcome back,
Rob. Thanks for having me, James.
So Rob, you, a fellow podcaster, fellow professional in maintenance and reliability, thought we'd bring you back and we'd talk about some more interesting concepts and in maintenance and reliability. But before we get into that, you're also the host of Rob's Reliability Project, which is a great podcast, and you send out a tremendous amount of social media quotes, which I'm kind of jealous of. I don't do that. I really wish I did. You also run Rob's Reliability, which is a consulting training service, correct?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, James, I try to do a lot for everybody. So right now, the obviously Rob's Reliability Project, it's a weekly podcast similar to yours, and it comes out once a week on Tuesday. Other than that, I put out a daily quote and a daily audio tip. So those are two little small things for people every day. And then even since I stopped working at Fluid Life, I also put out two videos a week. So there'll be one video that'll be on my YouTube page or Facebook or LinkedIn. So if you're looking for that, Rob's Reliability Project on either of those platforms. And then I also, if you sign up for my newsletter, weekly newsletter, robsreliability.com, if you sign up for the newsletter, you'll get another bonus video just for that newsletter every week. So doing lots of stuff.
Yeah. And some of those videos are quite interesting. The sledgy was hilarious. And then there is the screwdriver one, which I just saw last couple days. Those are very funny and interesting takes on reliability. And then you do all the other ones where, you know, I saw the one with the ice cube and those sorts of things. So you're always putting out great content.
Yeah, I'm trying to. And I had a really fun time to do the sledgy and screwy videos. And I got one coming up. Well, I haven't shot it yet, but I'm shooting it this weekend. I'm hoping I'll get it out next week. It should be another fun look at least root cause analysis.
Excellent. Can't wait. So Rob, what I brought you on here to talk about this week is decision-making. And, you know, we make a lot of decisions within maintenance, reliability, asset management, all those things. Sometimes they're data-driven. Sometimes they're more driven on intuition and gut feel. But I wanted to get your take. What is your definition, I guess, of asset management decision-making?
Yeah. And that's a, you know, it's kind of a tough question. And the reason I'm super passionate about decision-making, and I've been involved with decision-making for a really long time. Like before I started my career in reliability, I actually worked as an economist doing cost-benefit analysis on large infrastructure projects. So the company was looking at building bridges or new railways or, you know, and trying to determine, is there an ROI to this? And that ROI, like we call it return on investment, but it also includes, at the time they called it sustainable return on investment, but it also includes environmental factors, social benefit, safety. These types of things we were all quantifying into the ROI itself. Now, when we want to talk about decision making, it's really important, right? Because every day we make a ton of decisions. Now, some of them we're not really making the decision. It's sort of just what we've always done. You know, like, should I have coffee in the morning? Should I brush my teeth? These are decisions that, yes, they'll have an impact, but the effects and the consequences of getting them wrong, not really that big a deal. When we talk about asset decision making, there's some big ones that do have big consequences. Like if we're looking, you know, from an RCM perspective, we're making decisions around, should we do predictive maintenance? Should we do preventative maintenance? Should we run to fail? These are some decisions that we have to make. And at the end of the day, it's coming down to economics. Yes, this broad term economics, I am still including environmental safety benefits. But at the end of the day, are we making the best decision that we can? That's the most important thing.
Yeah, and I think you touched on a lot of good points there. You know, there's some of those decisions we make just by habit, by routine. Others we'll put a little bit more thought into. But when it comes to asset decision making, it's about the economics you mentioned. Yes, that includes environmental, health, safety sort of thing. And I think within that economics, we're balancing what asset management is trying to balance, and that's the cost, risk, and performance of our assets. Now, the definition of performance may vary between asset class, same with risk, and so on and so forth, but we're trying to balance those things. And traditionally, organizations, how have they made those decisions, and why is there such a focus on trying to improve that and drive consistency and that sort of thing with decisions?
Well, to your first question about how do they traditionally make decisions, to be honest, I think the answer to that is the manager or whoever was tasked with making the decision, they would kind of do what feels the best for them. There was sort of a gut feel type of thing. In terms of how should they make decisions, we have to start with data. We have to understand what our organizational goals are. Like this ISO 55000, we have to tie that stuff in. And then we have to understand, you know, what are the risks to this decision? Like if we're looking at, you know, we'll use the RCM example again, but, you know, if we're looking at a pump, and if this pump fails, it's going to explode and it'll hurt somebody. Well, that's probably not an acceptable level of risk. But if that pump fails and, you know, maybe it shuts down our process for a couple hours, well, that probably is an acceptable level of risk. So we have to balance these levels of risk. And really looking at risk is where we're going to have to understand how much analysis we need to do to make the decision.
All right. Now, you mentioned that we want to have data to do this. We want to base it not just on that gut feel. We want to consider some of the risks. And I'm going to slightly disagree with you that traditionally it was done by gut feel, what that manager wanted. I think that is a huge part of it, but I think there is also a simple look at the return on investment, net present value analysis, just strictly on the financial piece of the upfront price. I think those are two things that traditionally happened. So
I would agree with that. Yep.
Now we want to move to something where we're understanding the risks of the various options. We're understanding the cost benefit for the individual options. We're using data to drive those decisions. But what about when we don't always have data? What are we supposed to do then? What about evaluating risks? How do we make sure we have all those risks identified and not just focused on one aspect of it?
Yeah, I mean, in most cases, you're not going to know all the risks, right? Now, we're lucky that we live in sort of a defined world. So a lot of, like some of these concepts that we're going to talk about in decision making, obviously they apply across the board to different industries. And for me, decision making, a lot of what I've learned in decision making has come from economics and has come from gambling, actually, where you're looking at how do we make the best decision in this specific instance. Some of those industries, like if we're looking at a game like poker, it's a completely defined game, right? We know the 52 cards in the deck. We know the various options. So we have a lot of understanding in what the risk is. On the opposite end, we have industries like the financial industry. Like let's say we're buying a stock. Well, the risk is actually very poorly defined. And that's why we get these events like the 2008 financial crisis. If anyone's listening and they've heard of, you know, the Black-Scholes model or Black Swan, those are risks that we thought we knew, but we didn't actually know them well enough. And in terms of data analysis, like if we don't have data, for me, what it needs to come down to is really what's the certainty that you have? And I guess it was maybe 2011, 2012, I went to the University of Toronto for their Seymour Conference, which is their reliability engineering department. And they, at that time, did a comparison or a correlation between people who are asset experts and their predictions compared to this Weibull model that they built. And there was actually a very strong correlation, which makes sense because people who know how equipment runs, they're pretty good at like predicting failures. And I think that that's how you can get away with a lack of data, is if you have equipment expertise in your plant, you can go to them and ask them, what do you see? Now, the more it's kind of like RCM again, different, you'll want to get different perspectives, but you can get away with that. And then what you should be aware of, though, is if you have less data, you should be less confident in your decision. So you should be able to, you should adjust what you do for that uncertainty. So you'll have more uncertainty in the decision and you'll have to adjust what you're making a decision on.
Yeah. So we're going to use some experience. We're going to infer some data based on other similar assets or similar asset classes, past experience, those sorts of things to kind of fill in the blanks. And then we have to have some sort of model with that data, with the understanding of the risks, the financial impacts, both short and long term. And I think that is a difference that we're seeing now. It's more focused on the long term life cycle cost, not just the upfront purchase price.
And I mean, like, if you look at it in terms of, does that make sense? And the answer is yes, right? Like I've done a lot of cost benefit analysis, but a lot of us, we understand that the majority of the costs from an asset are not that upfront purchase price. It's either the maintenance cost, the downtime, like the lost production cost, or all these other things. And I understand that a lot of us or a lot of companies, they incentivize their people on the short term. So a lot of the times we're actually making decisions because we want to hit production at the end of the month, or, you know, we want to hit profitability for the end of the quarter. But getting to that life cycle management, that's where we're really going to be able to make impacts in reliability and, you know, cut those costs over the life cycle of your plant.
Yes, absolutely. Now, what have you seen out there as best practices in decision-making? Do they have matrices? Do they have logic trees, logic diagrams? How are these organizations going through and making these decisions with all these variables and doing it consistently so it doesn't depend entirely upon the manager or the CEO and that sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, first off, you know, some companies do use a decision matrix or a logic tree. I recently had Andrew Curry on my podcast, and what he was using to make decisions was he was trying to transition a company from, I guess, moving from a reactive work environment to more of a planned work environment. And one of the challenges he said was a lot of the guys on the shop floor, like an operator would approach them and say, hey, this thing is rattling. Can you fix it now? And they were stopping doing what work they were supposed to do to go after this complaint. And so what he did was he printed off these little cheat cards, and essentially it broke down, you know, is this work urgent? Does it have to happen now? Can it be planned in the next 2 days? Can it be planned in the next few weeks? And just a few steps, a few questions that the maintenance guys could ask themselves to make that decision had a big impact on how much planned work they were doing. So that's kind of a micro level. On a macro level, if we're making big decisions, we can't really use a logic tree or decision matrix because, again, it's a little too complex and you really have to do some financial modeling. So best practices for that, it's really what I was used to doing in terms of cost-benefit analysis. Like, you're going to amalgamate all your costs. You're going to amalgamate all your benefits. You're going to plot them out over, like, essentially a cash flow statement, like, over time. And then you're going to apply probabilities and distributions to each one of your variables. And your output will be an expected return whether that's positive or negative, and then an S curve. So a distribution of this is the absolute worst case scenario and what's the probability for that. This is the absolute best case scenario. What's the probability for that? And then the distribution. So each probability and return over that distribution.
All right. So when you use that type of model, you're looking at the financial piece of things. Are you assigning a financial value to the health, safety, risk, those types of aspects as well? Or is that yes. only part? Okay. All right.
Yes. Yeah. So I'll just be clear to the listeners. I understand that it's sometimes difficult to apply financial values to something like somebody's life or somebody's health. Now, the one thing that I want to get across to people is that that's a difficult conversation to have, but we all need to grade stuff along the same curve, right? So we can't compare apples to oranges and make some sort of decision. It's very difficult to do that. So if you compare them all in dollars and cents, there's at least you're able to line it up. And obviously, like, let's say, you know, for a lot of us, if we have some sort of death at a plant, you know, it's going to shut us down for a long time. Plus there's this and that, like they will grade out to be unacceptable. And if they don't, you can actually make them unacceptable, like make the cost $100 million or something ridiculous. But you do need to kind of grade them all along the same curve.
This podcast is brought to you by Iridicio. Be sure to check out Iridicio's IBL Blended Learning for Maintenance and Reliability Professionals. This SMRP-accredited project-based curriculum will take you through all aspects of a maintenance and reliability program and provides you with all the tools you need to generate a 30 times return on investment for your organization and a set of credentials from the University of Tennessee for you. You can find out more at ibltraining.com.
All right, so what you're describing there by turning all that stuff into financial values is a benefit cost analysis is essentially what you're doing, because we're taking into account the monetary and non-monetary, but converting them all to a dollar cents. We're doing a benefit cost analysis, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
And then I've seen some others that are out there, like a risk-based decision-making matrix. I've seen multi-criterial analysis where, you know, they have the financial stuff, but then they have different rankings for health, safety, you know, brand awareness, all that wonderful stuff. That kind of balances in as well. I think the key thing behind the model is making sure that we take into account all those different factors, looking at, you know, the monetary, non-monetary impacts, making sure that all are being evaluated the same way, and so on and so forth. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I don't think you can do it any other, I mean, you can do it any other way, but it's not going to give you the best results that you need. And the reason that having these sort of standard practices is useful is, you know, you're going to see an organization different than I'm going to see the organization. And it's that if we can standardize how we make these decisions, we're going to get more consistency, which hopefully, if that consistency is aligned towards our organizational goals, we're going to have a better performing organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the key thing with that is making sure it's consistent. Everyone understands how that decision matrix works, or that decision-making model, regardless if it's a matrix or some other model. And also defining where it's used, because I think the models we use to drive capital decision-making are likely going to be different than the ones we use to drive operation maintenance decision-making, because they're two different things. Looking at two different aspects. Yes, it's all trying to balance cost versus performance, but there needs to be a little bit more work done in that capital area, because you're investing a lot of money. There's going to be a lot more rigor. You're going to have that stand up to the board of directors and so on and so forth, right? So I think those two might be separate, but we need to define when do we use each, how are they used, how do they fit into the asset management program, and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I maybe people would misunderstand this, but, you know, like, I'm not saying do a cost benefit analysis on literally everything in your plant, because it's going to be a lot of time and effort. Now, maybe that cost benefit analysis for, hey, should we replace this pump? Maybe that's a 10 minute or 15 minute kind of, you're doing it a little bit with your thumb, rules of thumb. But if we're spending $100 million on a new turbine, that's when we need to do kind of rigorous analysis to make sure that we're getting it right.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you're looking through the 55,001 or asset management in general, you know, we need to understand the level of service. Is the asset delivering that level of service? What's the remaining useful life? Plus the maintenance costs, all that other stuff. We need to understand all of those and wrap those in. And in some of those cases, it might be very, very simple. Like you said, asset condition is low. We're not delivering the level of service required. All right, let's replace it. Where others are going to require, like you said, models for three or four different options, you know, those sorts of things. So I think it really depends upon the level you're making that decision as well.
Absolutely.
Now, what considerations need to be included if we're looking at a asset replacement or repairing it?
Yeah. So, I mean, this question here, again, there's really two sides of the coin, right? So there's your benefit side and there's your cost side. And most of the time, the only thing that's going to be on your benefit side will be essentially your production benefit. Sometimes there'll be health and safety benefit. Like if we're replacing an asset, the old one is probably less safe than the new one. And sometimes that'll also be an environmental benefit. Like let's say we're having a leaking pump. Well, if we put a new one in that's not leaking, then we don't have that problem for the environment. But a lot of the times, something I've seen misunderstood throughout my career is, what is our production benefit or what is our opportunity cost? And one thing I just want to define to people what it is essentially is how much profit are we losing from that equipment not running? So that could be like, let's say that unit makes 10 widgets per hour and it's down. How much profit do we make on those 10 widgets? It's not complete revenue and it's not, you know, something else in between. Now you may have a buffer and this and that will take away from what the opportunity cost is. You'll have to figure that out at your plant site. But it's just something that I've seen misunderstood so many times throughout my career that I just want to make a point of that. Now, the other things are obviously your maintenance cost. In terms of asset replacement, how much money are you spending on a new asset? What's the time value of money? So that asset, like if we're spending $100 today, in theory, if we invested that $100 in a year, we'll have more money. We'll have, you know, 5% more, 8% more. If you're doing this type of analysis, your company will have a value for this. Those are some other things. And definitely you should be looking at safety, environmental benefits. The other stuff, the brand equity, for most of our decisions, that's not really going to come into play unless we're talking about something major, which it will. But definitely stuff like for me, from my career, one of the models I was looking at was replacing haul trucks was grading the roads for a haul truck. And the smoother the road is, less injuries we have to the driver. So something like that, we definitely need to keep that into our model to make sure that we're looking at more than just financials.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the one other thing that we need to consider is not just identifying the options when that asset is at the point where it needs to be repaired or replaced, modeling it out years in advance. So we understand how quickly is it degrading? What is it going to cost to replace? Those sorts of things. So we can kind of level out our CapEx. So, you know, if we have extra money this year, we already know what we're going to pull forward. And if it's a tight year, what can we push another year or two, right? And kind of establish that level balance. We don't end up running a big capital deficit where we need $100 to $300 million to upgrade and replace all of our assets at the same time, kind of phase it in based on the risk, based on degradation rates, remaining useful life, all those things. And I think that only happens with that proper planning, having that capital decision-making process in place that's requiring people to look not just 1 or 2 years out, but 5, 10, 20 years down the road.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that's something that, given that you brought it up, I'm sure you've seen it as well, is a lot of the times we're not thinking that long term. And really, we should be thinking about this when we design our plant or our mine or wherever. We should be thinking about, you know, in 10 years when I have to replace all these things, or in 20 years when I have to replace all these things. And hopefully we don't batch order everything and then expect in 10 years we're just going to batch order it again. It's that understanding that life cycle and trying to smooth out those types of replacements. It's definitely important, for sure.
Absolutely. Now, even if we have all this data, we have the right model, depending on the situations clearly defined, who needs to be involved in this decision? Is this just one person using that model and arriving at that decision, or is it more than that?
So it's going to depend again on what's the scale of your decision, right? So if it's a 1 gallon pump that we're going to replace, we can leave that to an engineer or mechanic. It can be one person because the impact of our decision is not that big. But if it's that $100 million decision, hey, are we going to replace this turbine or not? We're going to have to bring in pretty much every stakeholder, right? It's going to have to be an upper management decision. We're going to have to bring in operations. We're going to have to bring in finance. We may have to bring in health and safety. It's going to look a lot like an RCM facilitation group plus. You're going to have to involve your managers because you're going to need that approval for money.
All right. So it is that cross-functional group for those larger ones. Even if we have those decision matrices or models, we still need to have that cross-functional group agree, maybe try and, you know, identify risks with that current decision versus others and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And again, like a lot of what we do in reliability, it comes back to buy-in and its culture. And so if we just make the decision ourselves for a big decision like that, it's going to impact operations. It's going to impact maintenance. It's going to impact health and safety. And we really need them to support the decision. So even if it's just a matter of presenting, hey, this is, you know, the model that we built. This is our, you know, this is our recommendation. What do you think? Did we miss anything? Those types of conversations. Communication, buy-in. These are some big aspects to what we do in reliability, and it's the same with decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what do you think the one thing is that prevents organizations from making these informed, more data-driven decisions?
Yeah, so the first big thing that you see is time. So sometimes it'll be something like, you know, maintenance guy will run into your office and say, hey, this pump just failed. Should we put in a rebuilt one or should we buy a new one? You don't really have time to do much analysis on this decision. You kind of have to have either your gut feel or what you used to do or what's worked the best, right? That's going to be a big one. The next one I want to talk about is personal bias. So for us, each one of us has our own way of seeing the world. And we look at the world through the lens of our experiences. So how I make a decision is going to be different than how you make a decision. Now, this can be good or bad, but if we're trying to standardize across the organization, those rules of thumb, those decision matrices, these are going to be good things to put in place for the smaller decisions. So that's something that we want to make sure that we do. Now, in terms of like, how do we avoid making these mistakes? I'm going to give you an example from professional poker players because I think that they do it really well. And what I'm going to say is what a lot of these top poker players do is they spend a lot of time away from the game, doing analysis, looking at different spots, and really perfecting their framework for decision making. So it's when I'm in this spot, what should I do? When I have a decision like this, what factors should I consider? And what they do is they build this framework away from the table. And then when they're at the table, they don't have the time to do this rigorous analysis. So they've already trained themselves and they've trained their gut to make the right decisions. Or they have a process that's quick that, hey, these are the factors that I typically consider. And that means this decision will be this. And I think that we can use that methodology ourselves as maintenance people and reliability people to train ourselves to understand what our personal biases are and what typical scenarios that we get encountered with. Obviously, it's not going to be an exhaustive list, but if we can train ourselves to make, to have a framework that works, then if we get a decision that has to be made immediately, we have a good place to start.
No, I think that that's exactly what we're trying to do when we talk about these decision models, is build it away from that last minute decision, that point where we're into that situation. So the organization knows how they're going to make decisions moving forward. And I think we're doing exactly that with 55,000.
Absolutely.
Now, Rob, we've talked a lot about decisions. What is the one action you want our listeners to take away from the conversation today on decision making? What is the one thing they can do differently or start thinking about?
So I was reading a book by Seth Godin the other day, and I'll give you a quote, and it's, the quote is, "The most effective statisticians are the ones who aren't afraid to tell a story, because anecdotes are the way to navigate, or sorry, because anecdotes are the way we navigate the world." And I found that is really profound for me, right? And that's one thing that we have to be aware of as reliability people, is we can make the best decisions, we can build the best models, but at the end of the day, if those decisions aren't put into action by the people that are the decision maker, we're not effective at doing what we need to do. And so with decision making, if we can relate that to a story, people will grasp it and they'll be able to understand what we're talking about. So these types of, like, that communication is going to be super important. And that's going to be different whether you're talking to your MBA CEO or it's going to be talking to the guy on the floor. The guy on the floor, the decision may be something like, "Hey, we're going to replace this pump because, you know, it's going to reduce the times that you have to come in on Saturday. Instead of, you know, playing golf, you're going to have to come in. It's going to reduce that amount of time, so it's going to be better for you." And then the CEO level, maybe the conversation goes something like, "Well, you know, the ROI is 4-to-1, so we should do it this way." These are some of the anecdotes that you're going to have to use, and it's going to be different for each person that you want to talk to. And the last thing I want to tell people to do is, I was recently on the Improvers podcast, and I said something along the lines of, you know, it's 2019 and the quote unquote, "we've always done it this way" approach isn't good enough. And I got a few people, you know, they reached out to me and they said, "You know, Rob, you know, you've said this, but a lot of the times what we've done, you know, it's worked and that's why we're doing it." And what I want people to take away from this is take a look at some of those decisions that the justification is, "we've always done it this way." You may do some analysis and find that the result is right. And that's good. That's not a bad thing. Or, you know, throughout my career, I did it on one specific scenario, and I found out that it was costing the company tens of millions of dollars on an annual basis. And if you find a mistake like that, you can correct it, it's going to save lots of money. So what I'd like you guys to do is go out and look for a problem and kind of apply some methodology to it. So a good idea or good things to start off with is something that you, when you ask, "Why is it done this way?" you get the answer, "We've always done it this way." And the other characteristic is maybe the result is a little too perfect. So for example, are you replacing something every 10,000 hours? Are you replacing it after you've produced 1 million units? These round numbers, sometimes they're right. Sometimes it indicates that, well, 10,000 hours felt right to me. And those are some good problems to look at and to really dive into it. And obviously pick something that's worth money, because if you're going to do it on you know, a 1 gallon pump, it's not going to matter. But if you're going to do it on a transformer, a turbine, these types of analysis, that's where you're going to find savings.
No, I think that that's pretty good tips there. You know, make sure you tell the story with it. Make sure you focus on the ones that are important, the things that are gonna make the difference. Look for those round numbers. Because you're right, those round numbers are generally what someone thought felt right. Because if we're applying some sort of methodology to it, chances are they wouldn't be 10,000 cycles or 10 million widgets or whatever the case is. It wouldn't be nice numbers like that.
Yeah. And I mean, it may be like, let's say, you know, the perfect analysis, the result was, you know, 9,887 and we rounded it up to 10,000. That to me doesn't matter. But usually what it is they never really did they never went through the analysis portion and they just said, oh, that feels good. Let's go with 10,000.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Rob, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us about decision-making today. I think our listeners definitely have a lot to think about in how they approach decisions, what they need to consider, and how much of an impact it can have on their organizations. But before we go, where can people find out more about you, what conferences you're going to be at, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, so in terms of where you want to follow me, first thing is I'm not hard to find.
No, you are not. You're all over LinkedIn and so on, so and all that stuff.
So if you're looking for me, definitely follow Rob's Reliability Project on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook. Those are the first ones. I post daily, multiple times a day. So check those out. There's some cool stuff there. If you're also looking for more stuff, if you go to robsreliability.com and you sign up for the newsletter, you'll get a newsletter every Monday morning, and that hopefully will have some good content for you. I think I've been running it for about a month now, so hopefully people are enjoying that. And then finally, subscribe to the podcast, Rob's Reliability Project. It's on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, all the across the board, wherever you found Rooted in Reliability, sign up for that too. And in terms of conferences, probably by the time you guys are hearing this, the only one I'll have on the docket is the Asset Management Manitoba Summit in June 7th in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And then I'm also planning on being at Main Train in September in Edmonton. But that's all I got on the docket.
Well, I'd hope you'd be at Main Train, considering it's where you live. So, all right, excellent. Well, Rob, I will likely catch you at Main Train, maybe a few others if anything else comes up in the meantime. But I want to thank you for taking your time today to talk to us about decision making, helping organizations understand how important it is. So thank you.
No, I appreciate you having me on, and I definitely hope that people learn something from this podcast and really take a look at how they're doing it in their organization, because I can guarantee you this, there is money being wasted or lost because of poor decision making, and you can find it, and it's not that hard.
Yeah, it is not. You just need to take that time. All right. Well, Rob, thank you very much.
Thanks, James.
I would like to thank you for listening and remind you that you can always find out more on maintenance, reliability, and asset management at www.iridicio.com and by following our blog. The Rooted in Reliability podcast is a proud member of the Reliability.fm network. I'd like to ask you to please rate and review this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. It ensures the podcast stays relevant and is easy to find by like-minded professionals. It is only with your ratings and reviews that the Rooted in Reliability podcast can continue to grow. I thank you for providing the small but critical support. We'll see you next week when we dive into another burning topic with Rooted in Reliability, your plant performance podcast.